Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on a rainy, overcast Wednesday morning. We continue to begin our show nearly every day since the last 3.5 months with the poem America is a Gun. We'll continue to read that poem up until the election of November 2020. America is a Gun by Brian Bilstone. England is a cup of tea, France a wheel of ripened brie, Greece, a short squat olive tree. America's a gun. Brazil is football on the sand. Argentina, Maradona's hand. Germany, an oompa band. America's a gun. Holland is a wooden shoe. Hungary, a goulash stew. Australia, a kangaroo. America's a gun. Japan is a thermal spring. Scotland is a highland fling. Oh, better to be anything than America as a gun. Again, by Brian Bilstone. We also connect to everytownresearch.org, which lists the number of mass shootings in America, and they update it daily for the year of 2022. All right, so I am terrified of Elon Musk. I'm not sure billionaires should be allowed to exist. I mean, they could be human beings. I just mean they shouldn't have all those billions. But of course, we're talking about Elon Musk, who has more money than the planet. We're also talking about Elon Musk, who's actually developed a very, very fine car, which I hate to admit, but it's true. But he's also crazy. He's also erratic. He's also threatening. He also has too much money. And now he can do incredible damage. Not with the car, not with whatever he's sort of shooting up into outer space, but with the purchase of Twitter. Nora Benavides is the senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at freepress.net. She manages the organization's efforts around platform and media accountability to defend against digital threats to democracy. Well, speaking of digital threats to democracy, here's the headline at their press release. Musk's surprising reversal on Twitter purchase poses a fundamental threat to the network's users and, of course, our democracy. Welcome to the program, Attorney Benavides. It's so wonderful to have you. And I will be honest with you, there's so much on my plate. And of course, now with what's going on in Florida, you just can't imagine how you're trying to sort of move all the chairs on the Titanic. But this is terrifying. I was hoping that he would make the offer and then he would figure out a way to sort of back out and we could sort of breathe again. But apparently he doesn't want to go to trial. I'm not quite sure why. And he wants to go ahead with the deal. So explain to us a little bit about what you think he's doing. Do you actually think he'll ultimately purchase it? But what are the consequences of this erratic, crazy guy privatizing Twitter and now making it something that he has an ownership interest in, and yet so many millions of people around the world actually use it as a way to share information and actually potentially do damage to our sense of safety and security?
Arnie, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. And we are dealing with a lot of different issues. I feel like it's coming at us at just such a high velocity that, you know, we have the election coming up. We have global problems every day that we see in the news. And the Musk situation often eclipses everything because it's so terrifying. Let me give you just a little bit of background. You know, you ask, why is he doing this? What's he hoping to get out of it? I am not psychic. And frankly, Musk has played all of us with his will he, won't he since at least April in this Twitter deal. But the way it all originated was he had put out an original offer to purchase Twitter and take it private at a $44 billion valuation. Okay. And then he started backing away from that in April and May. He was having private conversations and slowly then started talking about the problems that Twitter had. And he agreed for a while to a purchase of a certain amount that was $54.20 a share purchase in April. Mm-hmm. And then here's what's really interesting. He backed away from that in April. And he said that Twitter had misrepresented how many people used its platform. Mm-hmm. Then Twitter sued Musk, forcing him to go through with the original offer at the $44 billion valuation from the beginning. The Twitter Musk trial is set to begin October 17th.
Right.
Part of what we're looking at here, we're not psychic, but we're looking at this is, why is Musk now going back to say, I'll honor my original deal? Some of us think it's because he doesn't want to actually take this case to trial. Many think he might actually lose, in which case he would then be forced to buy Twitter at the other deal offer he provided. Some think maybe it's sort of an ego play that he wants to save face because whatever might come out during the trial will make him look bad. Frankly, I kind of don't even think that's as important as the much larger looming problem of what will happen to Twitter if in fact he takes it private. And that is deeply concerning. Twitter has long had moderation and enforcement problems when it comes to hate and lies. But Musk is a free speech absolutist and says that he wants to bring back a kind of free speech protection for people. One, by bringing back Donald Trump. Two, by limiting the kinds of things that get moderated or enforced, which would leave up on that platform so much bad content. And so when you think about why he's doing this, why is he taking on this deal? I don't think it's to really open up speech, to protect users around the world. It seems like it is an ego play and that he's bored and it's his shiny new toy. But that is not how democracies work.
Right. And I don't disagree that he's bored and a shiny new toy. I just want, you know, he wants to sort of open this up to a free speech venue. Let's remember, he owns the definition of free speech because it's his toy. See, this is where people don't get it. When you own something, you get to take the R out of free. You get to take the E out of speech. You get to do, he will be the decider. Let's be honest here. In a lot of ways, just like Donald Trump, you're fired, you know, with The Apprentice. Well, this again is his ego trip. But the problem with this ego trip is that it is so potentially destructive, destructive to countries, destructive to individuals, destructive to businesses. And he is the kind of person who is so damn unstable that he will also use it to retaliate against people that will be undermining his billions in acquisition or whatever. And so the threat is so much greater than just even the threat to democracy. It's really the threat to the stability of the world, given how many people use this as a platform.
That's right. And frankly, it's really good to look at his track record when it comes to how he treats people. And he has a very long record of silencing, trying to remove people either physically or otherwise from situations when he doesn't like what they say. That is, frankly, an authoritarian tactic to try to take speech away when you don't like it. And so it's so ironic when he then claims he's a free speech absolutist because he has this record of picking and choosing who he allows access to his life and to his companies. Exactly. If an employee were to not like what he said, I have every belief that he would then find ways to make their lives harder, to penalize them. For journalists, when they ask questions that he dislikes, he also then takes it out on them on Twitter. He rallies his bots and his huge community of supporters against them. And what that looks like is sort of the early beginnings of someone who pulls together online communities to issue and promote hate.
So Nora, I'm looking at the press release and let me just read it back to you so my audience can hear it. Protecting everyone's ability to participate and speak on online platforms requires careful moderation. Musk taking the company private would likely threaten any notion of this, that's my words, and make the platform even more toxic to its users and the public. Quote, with or without Musk at the helm, Twitter must take a series of actions outlined by Change the Terms, Fix the Feed campaign to correct known failures at the company and do right by Twitter users. The platform must continue efforts to stop amplifying bigotry and conspiracy theories that pollute public discourse, threaten the health and safety of users, and undermine democracy. Okay, this is what you say. Now, what the hell do we do, Nora? This is going to be his private toy. There is no public, you know, he's not going to be on the SEC or the stock exchange. This is going to be in his pocket. He gets to play with it as he wants. I am just trying to figure out what is it that we can do as a nation, as an FCC? What is it that other countries can do to somehow control what we know will be grotesque misbehavior, grotesque abuse, and that will undermine anything in the way of stability? In fact, it's coming up like he's like going to be throwing bombs in strategic places based on his whims. So I read what you say, but what I'm trying to figure out is what the hell are our choices to be able to control this behavior?
Well, the deal could go through as soon as Friday. So we're looking at this as a very immediate concern. Everyday people, you and me, we have options. And one of those, unfortunately, now is the reality that we may need to remove ourselves from Twitter. A lot of people are talking about trying to just do away with it themselves and logging off. That isn't enough, though. And so there's sort of the bigger systemic problem we're facing of how do we influence companies that seem ungovernable, seem unanswerable to moral questions?
That's my point.
And that is the work that we do at Free Press. We are grappling every day with how do we try to build accountability within and around these companies. We have spent the last several months ahead of these midterm elections trying to influence and pressure social media companies to do better. We know there is a huge body of evidence now that social media influences democracies, influences everyday people, and the way we think about issues. And yet, despite their stoking violence around the world, these companies do next to nothing to actually mitigate that. And when we try to encourage and pressure them, we get very little. So with or without Musk, it is a problem. It will be even more of a greater concern with Musk when he has unfettered ability to pick and choose the speech he likes on a private platform. So we can leave. We can then turn to other platforms if we so choose, though there are problems across all of these. And then there are also ways that we need to look at other opportunities. And we need to look at the legal mechanisms. We need to look at policies that might help support transparency and regulatory reforms that intervene to try to manage what's happening on these companies.
So Nora, I would be applauding you and saying, absolutely, we should be doing this. We should be looking at what we can do legally and regulatory. And as you're saying the word legal and regulation, why am I ready to throw up? Because let's look at our situation. I'm listening to you and I am shaking. I am shaking. This is the perfect timing for Elon Musk to do what he's doing, because not only does he have the billions to do this, not only will Trump be like genuflecting at his feet because he's going to return him to Twitter because he so misses that medium, more importantly, look what he has when it comes to a court system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, try and regulate me. Yeah, try and control me. Try to establish the parameters. I know where I'm going. I'm going to that 6-3 Supreme Court that hates regulations, that's going to buy my line about whatever free speech is because I'm going to get to define it. So it's a perfect storm. It is a perfect storm, Nora. And that is what is so terrifying. We have so many matches that are being thrown at us to light up this like catastrophe, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's climate crisis, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's the cost of energy, whether it's supply chain issues. And then we have this happening just potentially this week. I mean, this is mind blowing, especially given the nature of our Supreme Court, that there is nothing that is the term regulation that they seem to want to embrace.
Just yesterday, you know, the new Supreme Court term and this period in the fall, they just heard their first redistricting case about Alabama.
Right.
And I think about that paired with the Twitter news that broke, and that what we're seeing isn't just going to influence the midterms. Though if Musk takes Twitter private as early as Friday and implements any number of reforms on the platform ahead of the midterms, that will absolutely influence what we see when it comes to violence, calls for violence on the platform ahead of November. Yes. But we're also looking at 2024. And without sounding somehow corny about it, this is where I think we have to remember how long change takes, and that the work we have done in the progressive space for decades would not have been so successful. But we're seeing now the fruits of those people who hate that success and the efforts to clamp down on it, to silence or otherwise delegitimize that progressive and equitable voices are winning. And that is like part of the message I hope we do not lose here, that 2024 is coming and more people are able to vote and are voting than ever before. More people are finding ways to engage than ever before. And so the clampdown, the sort of repressive backlash is a response to that. And we have to remember that we must then keep going in the face of it.
You know, it's interesting, Nora. So I'm old fashioned. I just turned 69 and I keep, you know, and I didn't
happy get birthday.
Oh yeah, thank you. Anyway, I'm still relatively new to Twitter. I'm even still relatively new to Facebook. I'm a Luddite, okay? But one of the things that I realized was that in a lot of ways, one of the ways that we can fight back is that we can disconnect from this or at least be aware of it. But I keep telling people, you know what? Start embracing the billboard. I'm telling people, you know what? Start embracing the Burma Shave ads. Mm-hmm. Start embracing talking to people. Start yeah. embracing knocking on doors. Start. I mean, now in some ways, the way what is old is new again, because they don't know what to do. They can't take down all the billboards, and they can't buy all the billboards, and they can't take down all. And so, in a way, postcards. I mean, it's like we almost have to take back the old way of sort of talking and connecting to people. And we need to sort of reestablish it as a way around the hate and a way around the distrust and the way around the factoids that are coming out on platforms where you think you should trust it. And then you find out they just lied to you. So in a lot of ways, not only do we have that, but what is even older is the franchise.
Yeah.
Take our physical bodies that get to sort of exercise the franchise. And I realize right now that, you know, they're trying to make it harder and harder for people to show up. You have to be on long lines. It can't even give you a bottle of water when it's like 107 degrees. But despite all this, I posted this picture, and you may have seen it, of this young Iranian woman wearing, you know, red, those red mitts that you wear in a fight.
Yeah. Okay.
And she's standing there, and this is she's standing for what she knows she believes in. And I was talking to someone the other day, and he said, here's the difference. She only has her body. In America, we have our body and we still have our vote. And given the fact that we still have our vote, that means that we have a 1-2 punch. She only has one. We've got to use both. And the one that we have to use first is the vote. And it can't be a slim margin. It has to be an overwhelming vote, like you saw in Kansas. And again, by doing that, we can then support the work of free press. We can take back these platforms and make these platforms places where we can share information as opposed to sharing toxicity.
It's really deflating when you think about the ways that the US is somehow better positioned than other places around the world, because I see daily anti-democratic rollbacks here in the US. But we do need to vote, and we have to make relevant for people in our circles why these issues matter. If we're not talking with each other, as you say, Arnie, if we're not building deep opportunities to sit with each other, we're not connecting anymore. Part of why social media thrives and confuses us and distracts us is because of the sheer volume. Their business model is built on distraction, built on disinformation, built on eyeballs seeing things that are not what we really want. And we have to remember that. We have to come back to center. And so the gravity that normally has kind of moved us towards this distraction machine, we have to pull back to ourselves and remember, why are we connecting? Why are we connected? What are we connected about? And how do we talk about those issues with each other?
Well, look at the term that Facebook uses. You have friends on Facebook. They're not my freaking friends.
I also never see their stuff. Like, I only see ads now, which is part of their business model. You know, I don't see photos of puppies anymore.
Well, it's just, but the fact that they even use the term friends is so disingenuous. And I'm going to share a story, since you do Free Press. This is an old, old story, just because I'm sort of an old woman. But I replaced Rush Limbaugh on five stations many, many years ago when his original stations were bought up. And these stations lost their access to Rush because they weren't part of Clear Channel or whatever the name of the company was that bought the Rush network. And so this guy came up to me and said, I want you to replace Rush. And I said, me? I'm like the exact opposite of him. He said, yeah, don't get mad, get even. So I said, sure, I'll take the 12-3 slot. So I'm on the air. But as I'm driving into the station, there's this woman named Joy Brown. And Joy Brown was this like therapist on the radio, all right? And I am driving in, and this is around the mid-2006 to 2007 time frame. And I'm driving in and I'm listening to Joy Brown, and some guy is calling her up, I swear to God. And he's talking about this incredible sexual relationship he's having on the internet. And he's describing their love and their intimacy and their all this stuff. And I'm listening to this and I'm waiting to see how Joy is going to respond. And let me tell you that her response is something you should hold on to. This is what she said to him. She said, you're not having sex, sir. You are typing. Oh my God, I want the world to hear that every day. You're not my friend. You just connect on Facebook. You're not having sex. You are typing. That all these things are artificial and distracting and not human. And you don't feel someone's, you don't know what they smell like. You don't see their sweat. It's all these things that are so artificial. And unfortunately, life is not lived in the artificial. It has to be lived in what's real. And so again, that was one of the reasons why I'm terrified about what Elon Musk will do, because he's such a terrifying figure with wicked too much money to buy and sell countries, too much money to buy and sell politicians, too much money. Frankly, let's be honest. The Supreme Court has been bought. You know that. And I know that, Nora. We want to believe it's something different, but it's not. It was bought. You know, the Federalist Society may have been their cloak, but trust me, the money went through the Federalist Society and Donald Trump didn't give a crap and said, what do you want? So as we look at this, I look at the idea of regulation. I look at the idea of still using the legal system, but it's just gotten so much harder. But the one thing they can't do is take away who we are and our need for intimacy and our need for connection. And they are trying to take away our vote, but they haven't accomplished it yet. And I think you're right. 2022 is important, but God help us for 2024.
And unfortunately, Arnie, you know, the future of connection, I say this really heavy, is online. And what that means is we have to find ways to talk with people about why their online experience is not their own right now. Whatever Elon Musk does with Twitter, people will stay on around the world. And we are incredibly passive when we're on these platforms as people. You know, you sit in bed, you sit on your couch and you scroll, and we're not active beings. We are not agents of our lives when we are on these platforms. We are scrolling. We are sort of experiencing what others have given to us. When Elon Musk, if he takes this company private and gives us hate, lies, extremism on that platform, and people sit there passively consuming it, that will change the way we interact with others.
So give me some guidance before I let you go. I only have a few minutes left. You've got to come back, Nora. And that is, okay, I am not a passive user of Twitter. In fact, when I see someone lie, I point it out. When I see them misdirecting, I let them know. When they sort of accuse me of this, I slap them back. And, you know, some guy that I don't know, a high school teacher from Dover said, I just freaking love you, Arnie Orson. Where do you get your spine? But I am trying to role model a spine. I am trying to role model not being passive. I am trying to role model, don't see the lie and roll your eyes, shut it down. And if they come back at you, that's fine. Let them read the crap that they're saying because they sound even more insane, but don't allow them to get away with it. And yet I'm not, is that the right thing? Am I engaging or am I preventing?
Oof, Arnie, I am a lawyer, not a psychologist. So I have to be clear.
I know.
Here's my two cents, because I've worked for so many years with people identifying and helping people identify misleading and frankly lies, you know, online.
Right.
The business model incentivizes engagement. So when you respond to someone, we as other users may not see your response, but I may see the lie, because we do not know, given the lack of transparency from these companies, what they show other people. So in your good faith effort to call out what is happening, what someone else has posted, you have no idea what a company then and their algorithms and their AI are doing with your post. All that might do is incentivize the algorithms to boost the original post. I can't guarantee it, but it's such a layered process that what that means then is maybe you're really engaging with people and that's meaningful. But I also urge all of us to not just call people out, but to call them in, to try to understand what are people's values when they post something that's a lie. How do we engage with others to try to better understand? We are so divided, we are so caustic towards others that we often do not have an opportunity to engage in deep discussion. And that is why social media is so difficult to overcome and move around.
And I don't want to go lie for lie or tit for tat. I mean, you don't know me, but I was on my way to becoming a Methodist minister. And when I ran for office, people used to say I used to preach. I'm the kind of person that always wants to set the table with as many diverse voices as possible. And I think that that's important because there's a piece of their anger and even of their lies that's based in some kind of legitimate hurt most of mm-hmm. the time. All right. And so I want to understand where that comes from so that I can then figure out how to have this relationship. And one of the other things I do is I make sure that if there is this misinformation being put out on Twitter, I make sure that it's discussed in many other venues. This is what's being said. So on Facebook, this is what the truth is. On another radio show, this is what is being said. This is what. So I want to make sure that I surround them with the facts and the values. So it isn't just Twitter that occupies that space. But I've made sure that I've seeded it everywhere so people know better. And mm-hmm. it's hard. It's absolutely hard. And I'm still learning and struggling, but I know that I have to figure out, you know, how to fight this. And in part because I just have a new grandchild and I'm frightened for her life, but I'm frightened for all of our lives. Nora, thank you so much for doing this. Nora Benavides is Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights at freepress.net. I recommend that you read everything that Free Press puts out. And more importantly, they are part of how we learn to fight back and understand what the issues are. Again, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. Anyway, this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. And it's 2019, but it feels like 19.
Edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on a drizzly Wednesday morning. So we had the wonderful opportunity the other day of interviewing Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com. And I told Dahlia after we interviewed her about her book, Lady Justice, that I have this dream that someday I will come back. And I can't decide whether I want to come back as Dahlia or Mark. Because if I come back as Mark, I get to work with Dahlia. If I come back as Dahlia, I get to work as Mark. And the reason I'm saying that is that we have Mark Joseph Stern, who is a Slate senior writer. He also, like Dahlia, covers the courts and justice. The two of them are phenomenal. They dance so well together when they sort of cover these issues. And I am so grateful that I get to sort of hang out, especially with Mark, on so many occasions, because what's happening at the Supreme Court is devastating, and we need to understand it. And they're moving at Mach pace. I mean, they are just going so swiftly in sort of dismantling everything I have been taught and everything I value and everything I believe in. And it's not just who they are on this bench, but it's the speed in which they are operating that absolutely terrifies me. And so I want to welcome Mark Joseph Stern from Slate.com and tell him I had a blast with Dahlia yesterday. But more importantly, you wrote an article and it really touched me because there's a law school three blocks away. I rent to law students. I'm always sort of calling the law school saying, invite this person, talk about this topic. You know, I'm such a pain. And The article you wrote was, "The Supreme Court is blowing up law school too." And I started reading it because I understood why you were writing it. And then at the very, very end of the piece, I understood it was both a love letter and a condolence card to your father, who's a law professor who retired in May. And I thought, oh my God, he's just walking away when maybe to some extent we need him to be 40 years younger to stick around. So let me welcome you to the program and talk to me and my audience about what you're hearing from law professors who really do value the law, who want to trust a judiciary. They know that they make decisions that they don't agree with, but usually there's at least some sort of foundation or roots within some logical system that explains how they are getting to this decision. But this seems to be such a highly politicized court that looking back doesn't dictate to you how, in fact, they will behave today. So welcome to the program.
Thank you, Arnie. And yeah, you know, I could have for this piece interviewed a lot of cynical, burned out professors who have always seen the court as just political partisan hackery. But for this piece, I really wanted to talk to folks who have had the scales fall from their eyes or who have been sort of heartbroken, who really did once believe in the Supreme Court as the great guardian of civil rights and civil liberties, as the last bastion of democracy, the protector of voting rights that we all were told rose to the challenge in the 1960s and gave us or helped give us a second civil rights movement, all of that. Of course, you know, what we're seeing now looks nothing like that. What we're seeing is a super conservative, very partisan court that is implementing the Republican Party's policy choices from the bench. So I focused on law professors who have had this evolution in the last few years. And what I found was a lot of heartbreak, a lot of genuine sorrow about what the court was doing. One professor I spoke with was literally crossing the border when the horrible Muslim ban decision came down and felt like, I don't even know if I want to go back to America after this. And then, of course, the Roe v. Wade decision, you know, I spoke with lawyers and law professors who focus on reproductive rights, who teach reproductive rights every day, who knew this was coming on an intellectual level, but still felt like they had been just slapped across the face when the decision came down for so many reasons. I think it's a somewhat depressing piece at points, but I do want to lift up the fact that every single professor I spoke with, no matter how disillusioned they are, no matter how sad they are, they all want to stay in the game, with the exception of my dad, who retired because he's old and he had the choice. But the younger professors, they are still glad they chose this path in life. They chose this career. And the reason why is because they love their students. They feel like over the last few years, especially, their students have become even more kind of savvy and motivated in dealing with and addressing and confronting this crisis, and that their students are there to learn, not just the intellectual stuff and what they need to pass the bar, but the tools to fight back, to bring and restore justice to the judiciary that is supposed to dole it out equally without fear or favor. So it was a very interesting and a gratifying piece to write. And if there is any hope at all, it is in those law students who are sitting in class right now as we speak, slogging through 1L or 2L or 3L, and just, you know, spending all of that time and money that is necessary to become a lawyer and try to right size the ship and bring things back to where they believe they should have always been.
Let me end with your bouquet. Law professors who remain years away from retirement do not have this escape hatch, as you were describing your dad. They are already back in the classroom, bracing for another brutal term of precedent-smashing rulings. It's not all bad. The students give them hope, keeping them afloat in darker moments. As Mayari put it, students have clued in to what's going on, yet they persist in their legal education because they believe there's still a real chance for change. There's inspiration in that. In a recent class, Bridges candidly discussed the enormous challenges facing the legal profession today. The students were angry and fearful, yet they were readily offered ideas to help tackle current crises head on. "I always leave class feeling great," Bridges says. "It's kind of like therapy." I remember giving a law school graduation speech back in 2006, and I had just come back from Israel. And one of the things that I said to the students was that what is legal may not be just. And I think that's an important message. It's an important message to law students. It's an important message. They are going to make certain things legal. They are not right, and they are not just. And we need to be able to distinguish between the difference. And that's one of the reasons why these young people will say, okay, what can we do to fight back? We don't necessarily have the old tools. We now need to create new tools. And I think that that's where that inspiration comes. Speaking of inspiration, let's talk about day one with Ketanji Brown Jackson. You have two articles about her. The first one was, I love this, excelled at the skill Stephen Breyer never quite mastered. And I didn't realize that she was an award-winning debater when she was in high school. God, she was such a freaking nerd even back then. But you know, it's so cute to sort of see that skill, and now that skill in high school is now something we are going to so value, because with a 6-3 court, you may not be able to be on the majority side, but you are going to lay a verbal foundation for people to go, and they did that with their decision, because she will have so exposed the rot of what they're doing. And then you have Sotomayor, who just doesn't stop. Her pen is like a stiletto, and she gives us so much in the way of understanding. And in a lot of ways, maybe she's also giving us a bit of a GPS on what it is that we need to be prepared for, and then how we have to go forward to fight. So tell us first about her first day on the bench, because normally people assume, well, you're the new kid, you know, you should be quiet, you should listen, you should get used to the atmospherics. No way, that's not how she behaved.
Yeah, that was not KBJ style. Some justices stay silent their first argument. Some of them ask one or two questions. She was all over the place. She was just suddenly jumping in to contest various points that were made by both sides, but especially in this first case by the conservative lawyer who is trying to give landowners in the United States a kind of limitless ability to destroy wetlands that happen to be on their property. And she's so brilliant. She just started with the text of the statute, which, you know, these guys are textualists, right? They're supposed to focus on the text, and read off to the lawyer over and over again, like different parts of the statute that totally blew up his argument for why landowners can just dump gravel into wetlands and destroy them. And she kept saying, you know, it's the Clean Water Act. It's a law. I have it here. I will quote from it. And what I loved is that she was so quick and quick-witted and to the point, and was able to really kind of devastate the conservative lawyer's arguments with just a couple of sentences. And what a contrast that is from Justice Stephen Breyer, who was one of the most self-indulgent questioners ever to sit on the bench, who got incredibly bogged down in these very narrow, arcane details of the case, who would just go on for pages and pages asking these convoluted circular questions that didn't lead anywhere. Brought the whole thing to a standstill. It was really bad tactically. And in KBJ is just the exact opposite. She fits right in with Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan. They tag team each other beautifully. They follow up on each other's points. At one moment in arguments, KBJ asked this question and Sotomayor just jumped in and said, a footnote. I want to add a footnote to her question. And I loved it. I just really loved it, because that is what we need from a three justice liberal minority. You know, there's only three of them, as you said. They really do not have a huge effect on the outcome of cases anymore. The only thing they can do is lay down markers and say, this is wrong and here's why, and shame their colleagues when their colleagues are peddling this nonsense on the bench, and force them to confront the realities of what they're doing, which is manipulating and warping the law to meet the outcomes that they want rather than applying it fairly.
I keep thinking about the three women. I'm going, there used to be a radio show called Three Chicks Dishing. And I'm listening to you describe it. I mean, again, they are working. The beauty of this is that it's not about their egos, everyone. You see, what you were describing with Breyer is about ego. It's no, unfortunately, it's a very sort of male thing, you know? But these three women, not only do they tag team, but in a lot of ways, I think they're trying to create this quilt for us so that we understand by taking these different pieces, fitting them together so that they paint a picture. So even if the majority gets the success of a decision, they will have so enveloped it with all the flaws that it will be obvious to us that what they were doing was not legal, but political.
Think about the history here with Justice Ginsburg, right, RBG, and the Voting Rights Act case or the Hobby Lobby case, where when you hear about those decisions, I suspect the first thing you think is they're wrong, and you know why they're wrong. And that's because Justice Ginsburg laid it out so beautifully and so clearly that, you know, the majority opinion just did not and could not stand alone. It has to be kind of tarnished by RBG's brilliant dissent. That's what I think we will get from KBJ. I think we will get that kind of very strong and blunt pushback to the majority's nonsense. And it will become impossible to think about some of these upcoming majority decisions without thinking about the dissent that devastates it from top to bottom.
There was also the other case with Alabama. So I've been seeing people tweeting out, a lot of my friends who are lawyers or whatever, and I just saw a tweet from Mother Jones, and I want you to talk a little bit about this. Alabama wants to pervert the 14th Amendment to gut voting rights. So Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson decided to give them a much needed history lesson. Oh, as it turns out, originalism isn't just for conservatives anymore. And again, I mean, so I just want to go back to you mentioning RBG, because the beauty of what we see now is that RBG would write some amazing things and you would read her dissents into it, but she doesn't have the same, I think, the same sort of maybe heft, maybe because she was such an older woman, as Ketanji Brown Jackson does. So you now have the audio of what she says. You now can share the words so that people can hear it as she said it from the bench. You don't have to wait months for the frickin' decision to read the dissent, because what she's done is she's verbally given you the dissent. And that, I think, is so important, because we need these bookends. We need the dissent in writing, but we need to hear it from the bench. And she's so good at delivering that verbal discussion. And as someone said, it was like going to class by listening to Ketanji Brown Jackson as she talked about the 14th Amendment. And I think this is really important. Tell my audience what she did.
So what she delivered was a masterclass history lesson in what the 14th Amendment was actually designed to do, which was, among other things, create equal rights for Black people, not just all races, but specifically Black people, to bring them to the same level as white people and to provide a constitutional foundation for the Civil Rights Law of 1866. And what she explained, and this is so important because it gets lost in the history, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 was not colorblind. It described the rights of white people and specifically and expressly said, we need Black people to be given these same rights and to be lifted up so that they have the same equal opportunities. And this notion that the 14th Amendment, that the Equal Protection Clause require colorblindness, that, you know, things like affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act are all an affront to equal protection because they take race into account. KBJ explained, that's just nonsense. That is ahistorical. It is atextual. It does not comport with the history of the 14th Amendment, which was a color-conscious remedy. It was designed to ensure that Black people, that the freedmen, the folks who had been held in slavery, that they were lifted up to the same level of equality as white people, including by affirmative action. You know, the people who wrote the 14th Amendment created the first affirmative action programs in the United States. They created the Freedmen's Bureau. They created special programs for people of color, for Black people, to ensure that they could exercise these rights equally. And that is just, I think, a very powerful lesson in why the Voting Rights Act is perfectly constitutional, why affirmative action is constitutional, and why Justice Clarence Thomas, when he talks about a colorblind constitution, when he says that, you know, there's no consideration of race anywhere or else it's an equal protection violation, that is just anti-originalist and wrong. It does not adhere to the original meaning of the 14th Amendment.
Excuse me, wait a minute. Remember the three-fifths? What was that for? I mean, let me just, as you were talking about the originalists and what the Constitution, I'll never forget watching the musical 1776. You've heard me say this before. Don't watch the frickin' movie. Watch the play. The movie's too whatever. But I'm watching it, and it was one of the most painful, emotionally exhausting musicals I've ever watched, because you realize what they were compromising on. And they were compromising on who had humanity and who did not. That's what they were doing, and they knew it was wrong. Both sides knew it, even those that owned slaves knew it. And when you watch this musical of all things, you don't even need to like read a legal text. You could actually just sit and watch a play, and you see this and you just leave so sad, so sad. But you kind of know that they wanted it better. They just couldn't do it then. I'm so grateful that what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson did was not only talk about the 14th Amendment when it comes to the issue of voting rights and this, but she really is setting it up for the affirmative action, because she's going to do a repeat performance of this, because guess what? That doesn't change. The story about the fact that this was, you know, this was part of the understanding of the rationale of the 14th Amendment, it saw color because it knew whites had one set of opportunities and blacks did not. And if equality was going to happen, then you have to recognize blacks needed something that whites had. You couldn't be colorblind. You had to notice their color.
Yes, exactly. There's a brilliant law review article written about this by my friend Nancy Long, who is a law professor at University of Denver, where she writes about how the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which again was like what led to the 14th Amendment, it uses racial terms. It actually says, it is expressly color conscious in explaining how Black citizens can be elevated to the level of white citizens and what needs to happen in order for that to become the reality in America. And KBJ is saying the same thing about voting rights today, that the reality is that in the Black Belt in Alabama, Black residents do not have the same political power as white residents. They do not exercise political influence the same way that white people do, because they have been gerrymandered into a permanent minority. They have been subject to egregious voter suppression that is continuing to this day. And so when Alabama pretends that this map is perfectly race neutral, when it packs almost every Black person into a single district and gives white people control of every other district, that is not race neutrality. That is clearly considering whiteness and using it to suppress Blackness. And there's no reason why we cannot use the Voting Rights Act to combat that kind of racism. And in fact, it's what the framers of the 14th Amendment would have wanted the Supreme Court to do.
So what did the conservatives say? Everything you're telling me that KBJ said, I understand it. I relate to it. I see it. I see the history. There's no question that her interpretation is basically the interpretation of why that 14th Amendment was written. So I am trying to figure out, what did they pull out from the sky? What did they dig up? How malleable were they were with language to basically still embrace this idea of colorblindness? Because what she has laid out is so obvious on its face. It's so clear to see this originalist interpretation that I am just trying to figure out, where do they go, Mark?
I think it's noteworthy that Justice Neil Gorsuch did not say a single thing during arguments on Tuesday. He did not ask a single question. And I have noticed that Justice Gorsuch has this habit of not asking questions when he wants to rule in a way that is anti-originalist, that is anti-historical, but that furthers the Republican Party's goals. The same thing happened in Janus, the case about public sector unions, where the court issued this outrageous anti-originalist decision that hobbled public sector unions. I was there in the courtroom when those arguments were heard. Neil Gorsuch stayed completely silent. I think he knows that the version of history he's peddling is garbage. And I think he's just not interested in trying to defend it from the bench when KVJ has the mic and can shoot him down. In fact, none of the justices, not even Justice Clarence Thomas, tried to push back against KBJ's history lesson on Tuesday. And I think, again, that might be because they could immediately be rebutted by her in real time on live audio. And that's a big part of what's going on here with this dynamic. You know, the Supreme Court has only had live audio starting in 2020. And so for the very first time, we can hear this as it's happening and clip it, and it ricochets around the internet. We don't have to wait a week for the audio to come out when everybody has changed, you know, their focus to something else. People are paying attention when it happens. But the other conservative justices, they tried to defend Alabama by saying that it's perfectly race neutral to create a map that gives white people almost total control over the political process. And that as long as Alabama just stands up and promises that it didn't consider race, as long as you can get the Alabama Solicitor General to go before the Supreme Court and say we didn't consider race, that the map must be perfectly legal.
I mean, the fact is that the reality on the ground we should not look at because it really wasn't their intent. That's exactly right.
And, you know, when the decision comes down, I'm sure that we'll see Justice Roberts or Justice Thomas or Justice Gorsuch write this fairy tale version of the 14th Amendment that, oh, it was meant to create total colorblindness. It was meant to make a society where race was irrelevant. And that's a nice story. It's just untrue. That idea of colorblindness is incredibly anachronistic. This was an idea that arose decades after the 14th Amendment was ratified. It was superimposed back upon the Constitution, but it is not what the framers wanted. And if we are all originalists now, then Clarence Thomas needs to just read up and change his mind and understand that he's been wrong this whole time and KBJ is right. But spoiler, that's not going to happen.
So curious, how was Kavanaugh on the bench during this decision?
Kavanaugh said almost.
I'm always curious about him because I'm not sure where his spot is.
Very little of substance, but what he seemed to want to do is push Alabama to make its absolute narrowest argument, which is that creating a second congressional district for Black residents, where Black residents have a real shot of electing their preferred rep, that would just be too difficult for Alabama to achieve, that it would be so hard for Alabama to draw a second district out of seven in which Black people have real political power, that the state just cannot be asked to do it. And I think there's a real chance that's where a plurality of the court will land, that the court will just say, we really don't believe that that there's any responsibility among states to create districts where Black people have political power, and Alabama did nothing wrong here. That would be a devastating decision, not quite as bad as striking down the Voting Rights Act and saying that it's unconstitutional, but a classic Kavanaugh compromise in that it would incur, I think, a lot less backlash, but still do a whole lot of damage.
Well, I want to do justice to Justice Jackson and just read again from your piece at Slate.com, which is fabulous. The justice then went deeper, citing the report of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction from 1866. Oh my God, an originalist. And produced by the lawmakers who drafted the 14th Amendment. Quote, that report says that the entire point of the amendment was to secure rights of the freed former slaves. That was what your point was. Jackson explained. She continued, the legislator who introduced that amendment said that unless the Constitution should restrain them, those states will all, I fear, keep up this discrimination and crush to death the hated freedman. That's not a race neutral or race blind idea in terms of the remedy, close quote. Oh my God. I mean, if they had to be squirming because you can't say something when it's so obvious that the facts and the history say the exact opposite. But I'm glad that we now have access to the audio. I'm glad that she gave this masterclass. I hope that it's not just you and Arnie, you know, that the two of us just talk about on the radio. I hope they use clips of this. I wish they would make PSAs because I want people to understand what they wanted at the very beginning and why we are actually moving away from that original dream of the 14th Amendment. Because to a large extent, when you want to look back, you want to fulfill that dream and look what this court is doing.
Mark. Well, look, Arnie, my clip of Justice Jackson asking that question and giving that history got nearly a million views on Twitter. So I think we are well on our way to that goal.
Well, and again, I'm going to go back to the original article about her, which is, you know, from the get-go, she came out and you saw this master debater, someone who's so prepared for these arguments, someone who's so prepared to be succinct in being able to point out in a pithy way why you're terribly wrong. But I'm glad that you've got a million hits. I hope you get 10 million more. And I will make sure that people hear this over and over again. Mark Joseph Stern is a senior writer at Slate.com. He's the lucky guy that gets to hang out with Dahlia Lithwick again, the other person I want to come back as if I ever come back to life. And tell your dad, thank you for raising a remarkable son. All right.
That's so kind. Thank you, Arnie. I appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will see you tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.